And that was Nirvana from 1991 with the song Smells Like Teen Spirit, which was a hit right around the world for Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. And as a band, they were incredibly successful. But there are all sorts of questions around what happened to Kurt Cobain, his untimely death in April 1994. So I'm joined on the line by John Potash, who's recently written an article about Kurt Cobain's untimely demise. John, hi, welcome to the Politics Show.
Thanks for having me on again, Tony.
Why is it that, I mean, of course, you know, pop stars tend to be they're into excess, yeah, in excess, and they do, you know, they do this stuff. So why is it that you're raising questions about some of these stars and Kurt Cobain in particular? Surely what's going on there is just a high pressure lifestyle and it tends to burn people out pretty fast.
Well, Kurt Cobain was very political. He was very anti-war. He was very pro civil rights and, you know, very into a lot of leftist causes. And when researchers look through, actually U.S. Senate committee look through U.S. intelligence documents from the 1960s and early 1970s, they found that U.S. intelligence was particularly targeting political musicians. And a lot of CIA and FBI whistleblowers said that these programs that were targeting Americans and Brits, but were targeting mostly political Americans that were anti-war and pro-civil rights, these programs continued despite the U.S. Senate committee and the U.S. Senate kind of getting them closed down in the 1970s. They continued into the 1990s. And so I argue that the evidence is there that that Kurt Cobain was targeted for his politics and for his incredible influence.
Okay, look, before we get into the detail, what was the point of the CIA targeting these people? Were they just jealous that they had a big following and that the CIA is this kind of clandestine organization like MI6 that's not supposed to exist?
Well, the CIA was founded by the wealthiest families in this country. And according to a great British researcher, Francis Stoner Saunders, as well as top CIA whistleblowers such as Victor Marchetti, who wrote The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence, and Phil Agee, who wrote Inside the Company, a CIA diary, they basically recruited for their own – they put their own family members at the top of the CIA and then created the top-tier leadership with only the wealthiest white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Like Victor Marchetti was the only Catholic that got close to the top and said he was the only guy that wasn't, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male at that time and when he came out with his whistleblowing book. And so that's the way it works with them. And so they basically do the bidding of the oligarchs. The oligarchs are, you know, fight, you know, use the poor to fight their wars for wealth and, you know, for resources and also, you know, keep people of color down in our country. And so that's why they were, you know, against anyone who could influence people's hearts and minds that was pro civil rights and pro and anti-war. And so that's why they targeted, you know, a number of political musicians. And, you know, in my research, I show John Lennon, of course, but also Jimi Hendrix and Tupac Shakur. But right now I particularly target, you know, I particularly focus on Kurt Cobain because he was arguably the, you know, most influential musician of his time. They call him the John Lennon of his generation.
So look, before we get into Cobain, can you just give us a brief bit of, I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? You've got to have some evidence that mm-hmm. It's all very well saying the CIA are following these people, they're trying to influence them. Actually murdering them is a whole nother ball game. And I know you're absolutely right, through things like Operation Mockingbird and through my knowledge of the intelligence services working in newsrooms here in the UK, is that they definitely were interested in the journalistic influencers, you know, trying to control owners and managers of the mass media, editors of all the major newspapers and TV channels and radio stations. They were definitely doing that. And it isn't such a great leap to think, well, they would be also interested in anybody else that has got a big following and a big influence, including the pop stars. But what about those ones you mentioned, for example, Tupac, Hendrix, John Lennon? Is there actually evidence, real hard evidence, that something funny was going on? They didn't just get shot by a random nobody or have an accident.
Yeah, well, when I filed the Freedom of Information Act request for the FBI documents on Tupac Shakur, Department of Justice worker said she's not allowed to tell me how many pages are in his file. But then when we talked for a while about how I would get those pages, she ended up slipping and saying, well, there's over 4,000 pages in his FBI file and they cost 10 cents a piece. And that's why you're going to have to pay over $400. And I have the letter from the Department of Justice saying you have to pay over $400 for those pages, et cetera. And so I show the evidence in my book and film and that I paid for those over 4,000 pages and they only got 99, you know, and even those 99 pages were partly redacted, you know, covered up. So that's just some of the massive evidence I have on Tupac Shakur. But with Jimi Hendrix, there was an FBI file on him. You know, much of the evidence shows that they were following him 24/7, the FBI, but British intelligence was watching him closely too, because of the fact that he first got his rise in Britain and not the United States, because the United States was so racist, they weren't, you know, it was just doubtful that they would accept a black rock star in the United States. But in England, they accepted him as a musical, you know, a guitar genius immediately, and he rose in fame there. And then someone came into his life, Mike Jeffrey, who would say he was former MI6, but all the best evidence shows he was current MI6, just undercover. And he proceeded to control Jimi Hendrix's life to the point that once Jimi Hendrix was constantly trying to get away from him, but once he fired him within 48 hours, Jimi Hendrix was dead. And two people have said in their memoirs, well, one person says memoir, another person said, told some other journalists that he had, when he was drunk, Mike Jeffrey admitted he had Hendrix killed. But who can have someone killed within 48 hours? You know, it's only, you know, US or British intelligence, I argue. But there's, you know, loads of evidence like that for around those musicians.
Okay, so you know, there is quite a lot of evidence out there that John Lennon was an extremely radical character.
Sure.
He believed that the elites were insane. He's actually quoted as saying that sort of thing several times. And you know, these wars around the world, particularly the Vietnam War, was done by crazy people, mad people, and you know, this is obviously not going to go down well amongst the oligarchy. What
Right.
about evidence? Because as the official narrative says, that Lenin was killed by a madman, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, a columnist, a legal columnist for, I can't remember if it was the Daily Mail or the Daily Express, but his name's Fenton Bressler. He was a barrister in your country. We call him attorneys here, you know. He basically wrote the book Who Killed John Lennon after a 7-year investigation. And him and another author who was a well-respected music author in your country named Phil Strongman, I believe, wrote a book about this too and basically worked with some of Fenton Bressler's evidence, but then found more evidence of his own. And they both came to the conclusion that the CIA basically used hypnosis and drugs to get, you know, Mark David Chapman, the accused assassin of John Lennon, to the point that he got to, so that when an Atlanta police officer gave him Mark David Chapman, trained him in shooting, and then gave him the hollow point bullets with which to kill John Lennon, that, you know, to make sure the it was a successful assassination. They also Phil Strongman says they also had a CIA operative as the doorman that night at the Dakota apartments where John Lennon lived on the scene to further shoot John Lennon to make sure the assassination was successful. And so when police actually first showed up at the apartment building where John Lennon was killed, they first thought actually that this Jose Perdomo, he's got two other names in between there, was the actual murderer. But they also had this hypnotized patsy there, you know, Mark David Chapman. So they end up all being blamed on him. And so the best evidence is, yes, that you know, John Lennon was coming out of his seclusion. He was getting political again. He announced to the press that he'd be leading a Teamster march and strike. And he, you know, and he was coming out with his big albums that became, you know, popular immediately. And so he threatened to, you know, usurp influence from the, you know, Reagan-Bush agenda when Reagan was, you know, coming into office in 1980. And that was a extreme concern of U.S. intelligence and the wealthiest conservative elements that were.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at the Central Intelligence Agency, the director at the time was to go on to become the president of the United States, George H.W. Bush. Do you think it's feasible that before he died, you know, he actually knew more than he told about the death of Lenin?
Oh, sure. Of course. Yeah, he knew about a lot of the operations as CIA director. Yeah, George Bush Sr. knew about a lot of operations. I mean, the Bushes were, you know, intimately tied to the fascist oligarchs of our country. You know, his father, Prescott Bush, was head of Brown Brothers Harriman, who were convicted for trading with the enemy of the Nazis, you know, trading with Nazi Germany during World War II. They knew lots of, had lots of secrets and had lots of horrible, you know, motives and agendas in terms of, you know, on behalf of the wealthiest oligarchs in our country.
Well, hey, John, you know what? You've just sparked off something in my mind there, and that is that we know, don't we, through things like Operation Paperclip, that some of the most dastardly assassination techniques and you know, ideals, if you can call them that, of the Nazis were transported over to the US at the end of the Second World War. I'm sure there were a few came to Britain, but there was a very definite program to get Nazi expertise in warfare and particularly in things like space technology over to America.
Sure, no doubt. And you had mentioned Operation Mockingbird to control the media, but there's also operations such as the FBI's counterintelligence program, which, you know, 4,000, you know, many thousands of pages of FBI's counterintelligence program were stolen from an FBI office in 1971. And that's where they found out about COINTELPRO, the shortened counterintelligence program is shortened to COINTELPRO. And that's where they found out about how like 99% of their activities actually were targeting anti-war activists and civil rights activists, you know, from looking at those documents, studying those documents. And so that was one program. You know, the CIA had MKUltra and Operation Chaos. And so, you know, to go along with Mockingbird. And so those are some of the official names of the programs that were doing all this.
Well, you know what? Back in the late 80s, I think it was, I bought a book by Walter Boart, or right. Boart, B-O-W-A-R-T, called Operation Mind Control. Now, this does seem to be what is behind this. Before we get on to talking about Kurt Cobain, you know, it does seem that there is an attempt to actually use the mass media, including the entertainment industry, to tell people what to think, really, to give people, put ideas into people's heads. And also, I suppose it's a bit like the Pied Piper, when the music industry particularly is something that lots and lots of young people follow.
Yeah, no doubt. That's a big part of it, is they want to, you know, they know, you know, the CIA adopted, you know, the Nazi Goebbels dictum of, it's not about controlling people physically, it's controlling their hearts and minds to, so that they control themselves, you know, not realizing that their thinking has been influenced by the powers that be, and they're acting on behalf of the powers that be and not in their own best interest. And this comes up in the, you know, in the Senate Church Committee 1976 investigation of U.S. intelligence documents and projects. Those, you know, words of, that's what they were seeking to do. That's when they studied what U.S. intelligence was doing. That's what they, you know, that was their goal, and they were achieving that goal, and they still are, sadly enough. And they partly do it through, yeah, control of the media, but partly through control of culture and, you know, the musicians that we love best that influence our hearts and minds. And so when people like John Lennon is manipulated to influence people to do certain drugs, but then gets sober, and John and Kurt Cobain, you know, in the same way, when they start getting sobering up and getting more into anti-war activism and civil rights activism, they have to do something about that and do away with them, so they stop influencing people the run, you know, the way they don't want them to be influenced. And
well, this is the fascinating thing, I think, about your examination of this, John, is it's a sort of double-edged sword, isn't it? So the these musicians are seen as quite edgy. They're not averse to using drugs, and this is seen as a positive thing by the elite, that they're seeding effectively a massive mafia industry out there, which has also a big psychological effect on the population if they're sort of taken up with drugs. I mean, we've seen this in British cities in the 1980s, where crack cocaine was introduced, lots and lots of young people, particularly ethnic minorities, got hooked on that stuff, and they were depoliticized by it, basically. Then they started fighting each other to get hold of the next load of crack rather than being organized to fight the government. So can you just tell us a bit about this book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us? Because I think it's a fascinating concept that the drugs can be used for a while with a an entertainer as a sort of way to spread the idea that drugs are cool. But then all of a sudden, the entertainer starts to, like you say, sober up, and then they become a problem.
Right. Yeah. So my book and film are the book's got a longer subtitle, but the film's subtitle is The CIA War on Musicians and Activists. And basically, yes, that's what it documents. And it also focuses a bit on the Rolling Stones and the loss of the great Brian Jones, you know, their founding guitarist. But basically says what you said, but with Kurt Cobain in particular, I go into how he actually had a terrible stomach problem. And when Courtney Love came into his life, he had just dabbled. He said in his diaries, he only tried heroin 3 or 4 times because it did cure his stomach. It cured the terrible, intense pain he had in his stomach from a horrible stomach problem. But he would not use it regularly, and he didn't want to use it. He was, but when she came into his life, all by all accounts, all witnesses, you know, friends of theirs, people in the scene, said she got him using heroin daily for the first time ever and got him hooked on it. And so here they were, manipulating Kurt Cobain to inadvertently promote heroin. And sadly enough, every year from Nevermind first getting popular in 1991, heroin use went up 10% each year in the 1990s. But the thing was, Kurt Cobain found an answer, a cure to his stomach problem, and sung Penroyal Tees about that. He actually found a medication that would help his stomach problem. And by all accounts, he actually did get sober before he died, because month before his death, he was already talking to his lawyer, and we have this on tape, his lawyer on tape saying that he was divorcing Courtney Love, and he made her sign a prenuptial agreement. And so he's divorcing her. He was, by all accounts of people touring with him, he wasn't using any drugs whatsoever at that time. And then she comes and brings their daughter to him, Frances Cobain, because he loved his daughter, even though he didn't really want to see Courtney, he wanted to see his daughter. She brings his daughter to him, and he goes into a coma. And it was found that Courtney Love's Rohypnol, which are roofies, you know, it's legal in England, but not in the United States, these roofies, it's sleep medication in England, but, you know, of course not in the US, but she had apparently dosed his drink with Rohypnol, and he went into a coma and almost died. And it makes you lose your memory of what happened, you know, when you're dosed with Rohypnol.
Well, this is kind of what you call a Mickey Finn. I mean, she sounds like a very dodgy character. She's obviously still alive and kicking, but tell us a bit about her. What, you know, because she's obviously been quite a, you know, an attractive lady, a famous lady, the sort of person that a young man like him might think would make an ideal partner. What do we know about her?
Yeah, well, it's a long history, so it's hard to get into. I have a whole chapter on her, but in my article, I at least relate that she by the ages of about 4, her biological father said, and mainstream biographies of her say, that by the ages of about 14 years old, she was already prostituting. That's what her biological father said. He actually had lost custody of her for years because her mother was the daughter of extremely wealthy people who had stocks in Bosch and Lomb and uranium mines, and they paid off the biological father's lawyer, he says, Hank Harrison told me directly. And so he was in depression about that, but he ended up getting a letter from Courtney Love when she was 13 years old and stuck in a juvenile delinquent facility. And she said in that letter that, my doctors had given me all kinds of drugs, which happened to be MKUltra drugs. She named them 2-and-all, 2-and-all, et cetera. And it says that my therapists were also having sex with me regularly. And so that can cause dissociation and dissociative identity disorder. But nonetheless, I don't really get that into that in my article because it's a long story around that. But all I know is by ages of 14 and 15, he got her out of the juvenile detention facility. Hank Harrison did, as her biological father, and found that she was a heroin addict and was prostituting herself. And
I
so
mean,
she, yeah.
that's incredible in itself, isn't it, really, John? The idea that, somebody's taken into custody, protective custody of whatever, at that age, obviously, that, there's potentially all sorts of problems with a young person like that of either sex. And the idea is that they're taken into custody to look after them. But actually, what's going on is sexual abuse and drug abuse within custody. And this is where, she's actually getting that in some sort of so-called protective custody. That's
Well,
unbelievable.
what she was going to counseling from the ages of the ages change. Either she started counseling at either 2 years old, 3 years old, or 4 years old, whichever it was, by different biographical accounts. They're all, bizarre. It's a bizarre age to start counseling. As a counselor myself, I've never counseled a 2, 3, or 4 year old, but it's not impossible. It's just a very rare and strange age to start counseling. Nonetheless, she says that her counselors from infancy were having sex with her, and so that's really problematic, right? But nonetheless, so she's prostituting herself in Taiwan in with the Japanese mafia. She said she was a she, her own quote was, "I was a part of the white slave trade as a teenager." And so by the time she's a little older. She's set by 17 years old. Hank Harrison said she visited him when he was doing research in Dublin, and he met someone introduced himself to Hank Harrison, who Hank introduced to a guy named Stephen O'Leary, who introduced, who then met Courtney Love. Hank had the meet, and they had started having sex. This is a guy in his maybe late 20s, early 30s, Stephen O'Leary, and then he takes Courtney Love to England. And Courtney Love has on her over 1,000 hits of LSD, and proceeds to pass it around the London music scenes. Now, this copies what the assistant director of MKUltra did in 1965, in January of 1965, according to a book by A.E. Hotchner, called "Blown Away: An Oral History of the Rolling Stones." This CIA, assistant director of MKUltra takes thousands, takes tons of acid. Agents and money, and instructs the agents to put it in as many musicians' hands as possible. And so here's Courtney Love copying that kind of activity, and she sleeps with tons of musicians at 17. She almost breaks up the Pogues, Irish punk band. She and then she proceeds to copy this, and she's traveling with this guy named Stephen O'Leary, who ends up on his deathbed in 2005, writing a letter to Hank Harrison, said, "I was actually working for the CIA at that time." And Hank Harrison said that he was with his brother Kevin O'Leary, and who ordered him around a lot as if they were both CIA. No, I don't know if it's the same Kevin O'Leary is part of Shark Tank, and that Courtney Love has been seen in many times, in the press. Pictures have been taken of those two together. I don't know if it's the same one, but nonetheless, I did verify Hank Harrison's account that Stephen O'Leary was on his deathbed in Minnesota. In the obituary, it said, "Survived by Kevin O'Leary," etc. And so, Steve. So then, Courtney Love then proceeds to go to the music scenes in America. Portland goes to L.A. and other music scenes, and does the same thing. Has tons of drugs on her, passes them around like candy. Sleeps with the top punk musicians, where a lot of activism is involved with punk music too in America at that time. And then marries the top punk musician in Los Angeles, who says he didn't realize he was marrying like a conservative Phyllis Diller of some sort. He thought he was marrying a punk feminist. And she says that she slept with Alaskan generals, generals in Alaska, and that they told her that wars are good for us, and that he should shut up with his anti-war crap, basically. That so she was a right-wing, a bizarre woman. Then he divorced her. She ends up moving and planting herself in Kurt Cobain's life, and is dating Billy Corgan, and then just ends up at a party with where Kurt Cobain is, and immediately attaches herself to him. She gets, pregnant fast, and he does the right thing and says he'd marry her, but only with a prenuptial agreement. It goes on from there.
Who was this musician that Courtney Love was with before Cobain then?
God, what was his name? Roz Rebeck, I think his name is. I forget exactly, but yeah, that was her first husband. Yeah, he was apparently at the time he was, the leader of a punk band in LA that was one of the top punk bands in LA.
Amazing. Well, I mean, this is almost turning into a story about Courtney Love rather than about Kurt Cobain, because this woman seems like a kind of femme fatale, but with a difference in that she's actually on a mission to acquire these men and to basically take them down ultimately. And it's interesting that it's only once Kurt Cobain decides he's had enough of her that things start going wrong. So anyway, what about you mentioned that she gave him some sort of sleeping potion that put him into a coma, and that could have been potentially dangerous. But what about his final demise?
Yeah, so when he died, I guess it was a day or two before his death, she goes and hires a private detective named Tom Grant. And Tom Grant was a former Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department detective, murder detective. And so he really knew his stuff. When he turned into private detective work, he was already very seasoned as a detective. And She didn't realize that he actually did good work in investigating what was going on. And when Kurt Cobain wound up dead, he says, "Well, I've got a lot of evidence that points to foul play around Courtney Love." And he presented his evidence. He tape records everything he does, and so he tape recorded. He had tape recordings of Kurt Cobain's lawyer, who was also a lawyer for Courtney Love, saying that, they're getting a divorce. They were both looking for divorce attorneys. He was going to rewrite his will and writing her out of his will. And they were hateful towards each other. And but he's got a lot of this kind of evidence. And he also found that somebody used the credit card that was supposed to be in Kurt Cobain's wallet. They end up using it several days after his death. And so he's got the credit card statements. He talked to the credit card company that these statements, can only show up within hours of use, and that so somebody was, did have his credit card and tried to use it after he died. He also, tried to get some of the evidence from the police. First thing, the police just wouldn't touch his, Tom Grant's evidence. They wouldn't follow up on it. Secondly, they immediately, a police whistleblower said to some other investigative journalists, Wallace and Halperin, that they were told only to pretend to look at this as a possible homicide, but that it was really only to be considered a suicide, not to be considered a homicide at all. So don't do any serious investigations, anything, because we're going to call it a suicide. And they did. They called it a suicide the same day without checking all the forensic evidence out. The suicide note had two different handwritings, according to handwriting experts. They think the bottom of the note, the handwriting wasn't Kurt Cobain's. Tom Grant showed evidence that there was handwriting, practice handwriting of Courtney Love practicing copying someone else's handwriting, Kurt Cobain's handwriting actually, that actually matched the bottom of the suicide note. And that was in a backpack that she accidentally left at the lawyer's house. And the lawyer then presented that to Tom Grant. And so, a lot of this evidence is, some of it was copied in my article, that I published in Covert Action Quarterly, which was started by, as I said, CIA whistleblower Phil Agee. So that, a lot of this evidence is out there, and a film called Soaked in Bleach covers, a good amount of this evidence, as Tom Grant talking about this evidence in it. And so they didn't, they took weeks and weeks, probably I think it was a month, to actually say that there was no fingerprints found on the suicide gun, the gun he supposedly shot himself with. They also, didn't develop the pictures of the supposed suicide scene for about 20 years. Okay. And now pictures, photographs of the scene will show whether someone else's hand might have been overlapping Kurt Cobain's hand to make it look like a suicide, even though it was a homicide, because when the blood splatters, it wouldn't hit certain places because someone else's hand was covering certain areas. And so these are important, photographs of the scene are really important for trying to figure out what really happened at the crime scene. And so there was a number, as many points of police foul play, such as this. And so there was high-level police foul play because, as I said, Tom Grant was a former police officer and he had lots of evidence. He kept, looking for evidence for months after the murder and, this crime scene, we'll say, or the, death scene. And people kept turning him down for accepting the evidence. And so this is just some of the foul play that went on, including there was a death of a police officer who did go against his superiors and start investigating the source of the heroin that was in Kurt Cobain's system. And he was the first Seattle police officer to die in 9 years. Okay. And so now a top forensic pathologist, a former president of American, Forensic Pathologists Association, a guy named Cyril Weck said on national on TV that he thought it was a homicide made to look like a suicide. It was a staged suicide, and said, it's just some of the massive evidence that it was actually a murder. And
Any Nirvana fans will know that there were rumors at the time of his death that the band was splitting up too.
There was several accounts that they were splitting up. Kurt Cobain was thinking about doing some of his own things in a solo, act, or doing different things, different ways with different other collaborators. He actually had some female collaborators he wanted to do some work with, and apparently, and so yes, and so some people think that that's why some music industry people were convinced to try to, push him not to break up, and because they would have lost tons of money when things like Lollapalooza Fest he was supposed to headline and things like that.
Okay, so he's pulling out of a big festival at the same time. I mean, it does suggest that maybe he was going through, quite a lot of personal trauma. I mean, that's the sort of thing that might surround a genuine suicide.
Well, the people closest to him, his closest friend, said he was not suicidal at the time of his death. People that worked at the rehab that they kind of forced him into said he didn't appear suicidal whatsoever. And the doctors that saw him in Rome when he had that he was roofied, they put Courtney Love put Rohypnol in his drink apparently when he went to that coma, said there was no other illicit drugs in his system. And so he couldn't have been a heroin addict at that time, because to be a heroin addict, you have to be using heroin daily, or else you go through massive withdrawals. And so, and they said they didn't think it was a suicide attempt. So nobody, the authority figures and the friends closest to him said they did not believe, no one believed he was suicidal upon, examining him, so.
So it may be that was actually an initial attempt to suicide him, but it didn't work.
Right, exactly. Yes, and there was more than that. It was another attempt besides that too, but I'm not going to get into the details of that. It's a little more.
Amazing, amazing. Well, you mentioned there this whole MK Ultra program. Now, this is sort of actually only over the last 10, 15 years has really started to come out. We even had the BBC doing a documentary on it a couple of years ago. With you and Cameron up in Scotland, and various other psychiatrists and scientists of various sorts. What was MK Ultra, please, John? Because I think it's something that it'd be nice if we could just get it in a nutshell so we can understand what this program, this secret program that was unknown for decades, was all about.
Yeah, well, some of the top documents say the use of drugs for unconventional warfare. And people, when people think of warfare, they think of battles on foreign lands. But the best evidence is that warfare was on anyone who dissented from the government, the official opinion. And so the warfare, there was use of drugs as warfare against the anti-war movement, civil rights movement, etc. And the thing is, MK Ultra was 149 sub-projects. So there's a lot to MK Ultra, but it was, use of dozens of different drugs. The ones that we think of that just naturally, we think they naturally popped up, in our society, but a lot of them came from MK Ultra. And LSD was one of the biggest ones, but there, of course, the precursor of ecstasy, MDMA, was used. Of course, heroin and cocaine were used for warfare against citizens, and many different drugs like that. But some of those drugs were to create were used with hypnosis to create kind of patsies, people that would do things without realizing they were doing them, like Sirhan and the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Oh, hang on. But, I mean, this is Manchurian candidates, isn't it, you're talking about here?
Well, that's one term for him. I don't like to use that term because it makes it sound like it's science fiction. It's not science fiction. Like the Harvard University expert in hypnosis analyzed, studied Sirhan for 500 hours and came up with the fact that he was definitively hypnotized to do what he did to be involved in the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Right before Robert Kennedy was about to win, the Democratic nomination for president.
This whole idea of drugs, I mean, in a way that can kind of blow back, can't it? Because by taking drugs sometimes, people actually decide to actually drop out of and rebel. We do get some people that actually go the other way, John.
Yeah, it's possible. Sure, there could be some blowback that way, but generally speaking, drugs kind of disrupt life, disrupt our minds and disrupt our lives in various ways. Acid and ecstasy can disrupt our minds a bit. Cocaine and heroin can disrupt our lives, because the cocaine and heroin are more addictive, but the acid and the ecstasy are more kind of mind manipulating and a little bit more disruptive of our minds. But they of course have all these they have these things called there was a group called the Human Ecology Fund in the 1960s, which funded studies at universities that just promoted psychedelics. So they tried to pretend that, CIA journalists wrote these are mind expansion drugs when they weren't really expanding at all. They were really detracting. They might have felt expansive when you're first tripping, but when you come down from the trip, you feel like you lost a little bit. And but they're still doing that today. There's evidence that these foundations in your country, it's the Beckley Foundation, in our country, it's HEFTER and the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. All three of these foundations work together and put massive amounts of money coming from people like the Rockefellers and other oligarchs in our country. And it's that woman Countess Fielding in your country and for Beckley. But they put tons of money into the university grants to fund the psychedelic research that only promotes these things as supposedly healthy and positive.
Do you think that this whole program, particularly to do with the entertainers, some of them being murdered because they started going off on their own thing where they were supposed to be being kind of puppets, really, has any relevance to the way that the whole COVID pandemic has been interpreted? Because this is, an unprecedented, 18 months now. We're talking in August 2021. Of incredible measures against the population to really basically put a lot of people under house arrest for large, long periods of time, to criminalize some very simple basic activities like the right to protest. Do you think this has had any bearing on the way that this has rolled out?
Yes, because they wanted to do away with the most influential people over our youth. And when I say our youth, I mean our young adults, the people in their 20s and 30s and 40s. I mean, musicians are probably the most influential over young people, and young people are the most ready to rebel against the powers that be if they're if they try to lock them down with fascist measures. And that's what's going on today, sadly enough. The best research that I've found trying to make a film about this subject is the fact that the science just doesn't appear to hold up. Many top epidemiologists from Harvard, Oxford, Stanford, all saying the science is not right. It doesn't match. Things are out of whack. There's not. This isn't the whole COVID narrative is being manipulated. Best scientists from Germany and other countries are speaking out. Top scientists who isolated HIV in France, Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize for that, says that this is a man-made virus and that the Delta variant is being caused by the vaccine, he believes. He just thinks that, things are not right with this and that it appears to, a number of these scientists are saying, not all of them, of course, but not everyone's in agreement, but a number of them are saying this appears to be, COVID appears to be a bioweapon against the masses. and even the vaccine also appears to be a bioweapon against the masses, and that the lockdowns are unreasonable and do not solve the problem. And the masks are, experts have said the masks don't do any good. And then all of a sudden you still have to wear, everyone has to wear the mask anyway. And so they're finding graphene oxide, a toxin, both in the vaccine and in the masks. And that's being, first Canada's health board came out with that, and then they had to cover it up a bit. And they're covering up ivermectin. Ivermectin's a great drug, a miracle drug for this COVID and the symptoms, and it's being used in Mexico and India, et cetera, and all over the world. But United States, no one I talk to has heard of ivermectin, and so this is some of what's going on.
Not all the musicians have been either bumped off or steered and controlled. I saw Paul McCartney tweeting last weekend that he just had his COVID jab, and very proudly. But a lot of people were asking, questioning, hang on, Paul, why did you wait for 6 months, 7 months? Because you're in the age cohort which could and should have, according to you, got your COVID jab back in January, February this year. So you waited a long, long time. What was that about? But there are some. I mean, Eric Clapton and Van Morrison have released this song, which is called "Where Have All the Rebels Gone?" So they're, I suppose, asking the same sort of question to us. Where have they gone, John?
People are just kept in the dark, and people just don't know what to think and don't know what's correct. And I'm not saying I know what's correct, but I just think the best evidence that I could dig up, I believe that these are fascist measures, and that I try to stay safe, of course, and healthy, but I will not touch a vaccine shot. And I believe, like RFK Jr., Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a great environmental lawyer who says that the vaccine industry is so incredibly corrupt. The World Health Organization, I found, and of course he's found, is so incredibly corrupt, really controlled by the Gates Foundation, the second largest donor to the World Health Organization. Of course, the Gates Foundation itself was backed by IBM, who helped fund the Nazi regime with the holler and punch cards and the tattoos on the arms. So that's, it's just got an ugly history, and the oligarchs, I think, are practicing eugenics and a new form of, genocide on the population, sadly enough, with all this. But, I think that some of these musicians like Eric Clapton, I'm glad him and Van Morrison are speaking out, because Eric Clapton said he couldn't use his hands for 3 weeks after getting the second, vaccine shot, and he still has chronic pain after the second vaccine shot. And so, it's just, people are in the dark, but we just have to, it's up to us as individuals. Like, you're doing a great job, Tony, and I'm trying to get a film out about this and trying to put the word out about this. And, each individually, is all we can do is try to get more and more people, knowing about, what might be really going on.
Well, that's right. I mean, the thing is, people just don't know. I can tell you a little anecdote from when I was at the BBC working on the morning show down in Southampton, which was very well listened to. We had the very attractive lady that used to read the news on BBC South Tonight do the morning show on our BBC Radio Solent when I was down there. And this was at the time of the first Gulf War. Just as one of the big stages in that war was taking place, we had a lot of service people from Portsmouth particularly who were on ships, were out there. We had a phone in one morning where the producer asked and this presenter asked everyone to phone in and say, well, what do they think about this putting our servicemen over there, and did they think the war was the right thing to do, blah blah, were they worried, etc. And we opened up the phone lines and there was nobody phoning in at all. So I said to the producer, I said, well, look, hang on, what's happened, have our phone lines been blocked? She said, no, she said, we just haven't told them what to think yet. So she then bashed out on her old typewriter a very quick one-page script for the presenter. I rushed it into the studio just as the record was finishing, And she read this script out of all sorts of different things that people might be thinking. And lo and behold, by the time she got to the bottom of the sheet of the paper, the lights had started lighting up and people were then phoning in, you know, because they're saying, well, have you, she was asking, have people visited these countries before? Have they had service people in their family that have ever actually fought before? So there was all sorts of suggestions that the presenter was making that were then sparking off people to actually think about it and pick up the phone and contribute to the discussion. So you're absolutely right about all that. But anyway, look, can we just wind up, John, with if you could just explain, you know, where people can get your books from and what you've got out there and how people can follow your work.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tony. Well, to Drugs as Weapons Against Us is the book that talks about Kurt Cobain and all of the musicians and the CIA, you know, about the CIA world, musicians and activists. And I'm sorry, the film doesn't appear to be available to England at this time. It's available in the United States and other countries, New Zealand and Australia and Canada.
But, okay, so well, at some point it may well be when people are listening to it. So what's that called?
So the film is the same title, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA War, Musicians and Activists. And so, but the book is available over, you know, on Amazon UK and a number of other sites, you know, and some bookstores in the UK, I know. So thanks.
What about social media?
Social media, people can friend me on Facebook. It's just John Potash, JohnPotash. But I have, you know, you can go to johnpotash.com, JohnPotash. .com or also drugsasweapons.com. It's the same site with two different names. Just they can, you're welcome. People from England have bought my film, book and film from me directly. And I don't know if they can convert the film into your region, but you know, that's one way to get some of the stuff.
Yeah, there. You'll usually find a teenager that can manage to do that for you if you're having trouble, folks. But anyway, John Potash, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on again, Tony. It's good talking to you.